906.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's one story that always comes up when people talk about President Calvin Coolidge. While sitting at a Washington dinner party, a guest turned to the man known as Silent Cal and told him she'd made a bet that she could get him to say more than two words. His response? You lose. It's true Coolidge wasn't much for talking, but that wasn't because he didn't have something to say. Instead, he was frugal in all things, a value he first developed growing up in rural Vermont, and one that stayed with him throughout his life and career. As a young lawyer in western Massachusetts, Coolidge and his wife Grace bought secondhand pillowcases to keep costs down. While serving in Massachusetts state government, he said, "It is better to block a bad law than to sign a good one." And as president, he put that principle into broader action, reversing a growth in federal spending during the Progressive Era and through World War I by calling on the government to do less and spend less.
I want to cut down public expense. I want the people of America to be able to work less for the government and more for themselves. I want them to have the rewards of their own industry. This is the chief meaning of freedom.
Today, less than a century after his presidency, Calvin Coolidge is little remembered, but the author of a new biography of Coolidge says it's time for another look at the 30th president. Author Amity Schley says Coolidge's quiet confidence and his sharp character steadied the country after tumultuous times, leading to an era of economic growth and technological change. Today on The Exchange, Coolidge, the life and legacy of our 30th president, and let's hear from you. What would you like to know about Calvin Coolidge? Are there lessons from his presidency that ring true today? Call in The Exchange number at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. Our guest for the hour is Amity Schley, author and columnist who writes about politics and the economy. She's written several books, including The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Her latest book is titled simply Coolidge. Amity Schley will be speaking at the Hanover Inn tomorrow night from 5:30 to 7:30 as part of the Coolidge Institute's 2013 speaker series. We'll have a link on our website for that series. And Amity Schley, it's great to talk with you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Typically, when we hear about a problem in the country, the first thought is something must be done. And here we have a president who said sometimes the best thing to do is not to do anything. That's fairly provocative, even today.
That's fairly provocative for both parties, isn't it? We call him the great refrainer, Calvin. Do less. He was also a fabulous delegator as a president. He liked to let other people do the things that were their jobs. So that's different, too. I think now, you know, we tend to think of presidents as action men, whatever party. He's so different.
The great refrainer is not necessarily the kind of nickname that gets you big monuments, is it?
Well, he didn't really like big monuments either, isn't it? There is some footage of Coolidge at the very end of his presidency when he's deciding not to run in 27 at Mount Rushmore, and he doesn't look too happy.
Now, where does this value system start to develop? He grows up in Plymouth, Vermont, and it sounds like that was at least part of it.
Oh, of course. It's wonderful to talk on this show to this audience because some of this is regional, isn't it? He comes from a background where people move slowly because they're on a farm, and the animals can be unpredictable, right? And they speak slowly and not too often, and they don't always show off their wealth. That's the agricultural culture that we have still in the United States. In Plymouth Notch, the railroad chose not to go to Plymouth Notch, Vermont. There was railroad all over Vermont, but not there, and money was hard to come by. His father had a cheese cooperative at one point. They were saving all the time, and because his family were sort of, in a very tiny way, the squires of the town, he got to see, as a child, Coolidge did every aspect of life, collecting the snow tax so that they could pound down the ice so that the sleigh could go, collecting, you know, the school tax, and how hard that was, and how hard it was in the store, which his father ran, for the people to come up with the money. So he knew the value of a penny. Yes, that was it. And you can see if you go and look in the archives in Barry, Vermont, for example, Coolidge's own little notes while he was in boarding school about what cost this, what cost that. He was an extreme scrimper, and that was regional and came out of farming and out of a kind of Protestant culture of the Protestant ethic, too. But it was also, I would say, also an act. Coolidge thought it was better for the government to save, so he played the New Englander because that helped him to sell the idea that government should be smaller. All politicians have some theater to them, even Coolidge.
Now, you mentioned his father running the cheese cooperative and the store in a town where there was no train, and a lot of people saw that as a reason to get out into the world, but he stayed. He was sometimes called Colonel Coolidge. What was he like?
Colonel Coolidge, this was due to he had this rank not from a war, but because he served his government at the state capital in Vermont. Well, he was a giant to Calvin Coolidge, and this is a wonderful relationship to study all by itself, the relationship between Dad Coolidge, Colonel Coolidge, John Coolidge, the president's father, and the president, because it was almost as if a wire ran between them. They were that close all their lives. We have their letters, which you could buy at the Calvin Coolidge Foundation. They're just fabulous. He was also a quiet man, though not as quiet as the president, and could do anything, just about anything. He was even sheriff from time to time. He was one of the Coolidges who saved a lot. I don't know, you name it, he did it. Grandfather, likewise, we have some old advertisements. Grandfather put horses out to stud. He raised animals. So this is a family. They had to be jack of all trades, and they were. And they were the ones who stayed. This is Vermont. A lot of people left. We can quantify how many people left Vermont, and they would go out to the Midwest, where it was easy to farm, where it was flat and fertile. And these were particular Coolidges because they chose to stay.
And Colonel Coolidge was also involved in local politics. He served for a while in the state Senate. You mentioned he was a sheriff for a while. Is that where young Calvin started to learn about the idea of public service?
Oh, yes. And I should have mentioned that. I'm sorry. The Coolidges all served. Their Coolidges all over the history of Vermont, even a governor. And it was sort of they would send one of their members up to the state capitol, and he would represent the rest. And you get the feeling with Calvin Coolidge, the president, that he was representing his family, his father, in Washington. So, yes, John Coolidge more than once was in Montpelier serving. And that is when his son wrote a note giving him some advice. This is very lovely. A son advising his father on politics, because by then Calvin was already a ranking politician in Massachusetts. He'd gone down. It's better to block or kill a bad law than to pass a good one. Father, now that you're sitting down to serve in Montpelier, which is, after all, a smaller capital than Boston, where the son was serving. So this language flows back and forth, and this wisdom flows back and forth, and it connects very much to the Coolidge idea that you retreat from government and go back to your plow, like as in the classics. You go back to your plow because it keeps you honest. If you go back to your farm and do your regular work, nobody should be a politician forever. That was the Coolidge belief.
Today on The Exchange, a new book reexamines the life and legacy of President Calvin Coolidge. While the famously taciturn New Englander has often been downplayed as a major policy player, his presidency may hold lessons for our current economic climate. We're talking with author Amity Schles about this and about Coolidge's New England roots, and we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Amity Schles, we talked about how this area of rural Vermont and Plymouth Notch was not known for a lot of chatter. People didn't talk much. But even by that standard, Calvin Coolidge as a young man was very shy and talked even less than his relatives did. It's hard to believe then that he ended up in politics.
Well, that's right. And I do think it is as a sort of delegate. He was a sort of a delegate. He knew that he had to do this. It was just because he was son of and grandson of, you know, we're very much part of our families. And in the Coolidge family, there were usually some gregarious people. Clearly, his grandmother was wonderful and big-hearted and she was a midwife. She could weave, Sarah. And Coolidge's wife, when he did marry, was the most extroverted of ladies in a good way. She taught the deaf to speak. That was her trade. So her profession was bringing out the shy, the hesitant. And people joke that she married Calvin. He was a good pupil because he was so silent. But in some marriages, you will observe where one plays one role, one plays the other, right? Cal played the silent, and he was silent. It was hard for him to speak. I like his life very much because he had so many troubles and sorrows, so many setbacks. His mother died, his sister died while he was still young, and yet he always persevered, such a shy man. So it's inspiring to all of us who may have some setback now or the other time to see Coolidge going forward with such difficulty, though he was always afraid at every stage. But with the aid of these wonderful, warm people around him, his father, his grandmother, and later his wife.
And he did manage as he moved out into the world a little bit. He attended college in Amherst, Massachusetts, or Amherst College, I should say. You see him start to come into his own a little bit. He starts to develop an interest and then later a flair for public speaking, even despite his shyness, that starts to make him a known person on campus where he had been kind of a quiet character before.
Oh, yes. We write in the beginning of the college chapter that no freshman was ever less likely to succeed than CC, a class of 95, Amherst, 1895. He was so shy and so quiet, and he didn't have that much money, and he lived in an uncool place. And Amherst was an intensely Greek fraternity-dominated school at that time. And he was not picked for a fraternity. Indeed, he was blackballed, actually. And yet, after a while, he began to speak. They had more rhetoric in their classes. The teachers liked them to talk, to declaim. And people began to notice he sort of could do this, probably because in town meeting back in Vermont, he had seen his father do it. He'd done it, and he'd done it a bit in secondary school. And they could see that if you gave him a moment, he had quite a bit of humor. His humor takes some time. It needs pauses, and so it's not easy for his humor to be translated into a rapid-fire modern TV or radio, but it was there. And he had a boarding house humor because that's where they ate, right?
And we're going to pick right after that. We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue our look at the life of Calvin Coolidge. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Tune into The Exchange each week for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Laura Kanoy leads the roundtable discussion through the big stories from around the state. A rotating roster of reporters, editors, and analysts join Laura each week to examine the many sides of the issues. You can join them, too, Friday mornings at 9 here on NHPR. More of The Exchange coming up at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. Hunger strikes and revolt at Guantanamo Prison. Lots of high cloudiness, some filtered sunshine for New Hampshire today. High temperatures in the 60s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and the law firm of Donahue Tucker and John Della, offering legal representation to New Hampshire businesses, individuals, and municipalities with offices in Exeter, Portsmouth, and Meredith. And from Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people and needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899. Online at mascomabank.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with Amity Schles, the author of a new book about President Calvin Coolidge. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a question or comment on our Facebook page. Amity Schles, we were talking about Calvin Coolidge's early life, and he graduated from college, from Amherst College, and began to look into the law. He didn't go to law school. He read the law, which is a sort of an apprenticeship program, and his eyes and ears start to turn toward politics very quickly. What was it that he saw both for himself and then possibly down the road, you know, as a political figure?
Well, just I think the responsibility of engagement. All the Coolidges served in different ways. They were used to serving, and then going back, they didn't see politics as a job. They saw it as something you did part of the year, the way you pay a tax. And he fell into a law firm in Northampton, where he read the law, where Mr. Field and the other lawyers were all engaged in politics, running for mayor, this or that, or judges. And so he ran in a very small way, you know, school board, little clerk, and went around the precinct, you know, went around the town and got to know people. Interesting about this period is the period when the ethnic makeup of the state of Massachusetts is changing. So all of a sudden, there are Poles, there are Germans, they're Irish, who weren't there before, and he was in the Republican Party, which was the party of the newcomer at that time, or thought it was. So he spent a lot of time in churches, getting to know other groups. He did social work at something called the Home Culture Club, which was basically like Hull House, like a social workplace where immigrants and their families could come and learn things, how to knit, how to read in English, and so on. And you see him sort of in a very small way involved in that. So imagine a young man practicing law, shy, and doing all kinds of political and social work.
And his economy of speech starts to become not a drawback but an asset for him, because clients paid for lawyers by the hour, and they could count on him to do good work without all of the flowery language and the thick stacks of reports.
Right, that's right. The more you talk, if you're a lawyer, the more you get paid, right? Well, that's not so interesting for the client. And there's a famous story where someone raced in, imagine a very small town law firm. It actually worked for the Emily Dickinson, the poet's family, in one of the famous cases there where they, because of a marital affair, they squabbled over land. So this is sort of a Smith College or an Amherst College law firm that did town things, and Coolidge is the youngest guy there, and a man comes racing in with a problem. Someone has died, maybe on a little rowboat in a lake. What should he do? Should he move the body or not? And you know, where should it go? And interment, and what's legal? And da 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 da. And the very young clerk Coolidge barely looks up and just says three words: "Can move body."
That's all.
That's all. And they're like, "Wow, what does he mean? Are you sure?" And the older lawyer said, "Well, we found with this clerk that when he says something, it's probably right." And it was. The law said it was all right to move the body. And he quickly began to gain a reputation, and I teach business school, and I think about this all the time, of delivering more than he promised, more than the client expected. Shorter work, that is, delivering a cheaper price, or higher quality work. And that was a motto for Coolidge all his life. Give them more than they expect, then they'll come back. So we talk about this with, don't ever trick people, because then they won't come back. We all do business with people over and over again. That's very old way, and I like it very much, because it is true. You do meet people you met before again. It's hard to escape the world. And so he got loyal clients, especially among these poor groups. He represented some poor kids who might be in trouble with the law. He did that to build up his political career, but also out of a sense of kindness. His charity, and the ethnic groups quickly recognized that Coolidge was a good attorney for them. He even later did legal work for a beer brewery, that would be the Germans, in the town. Remember, this is a period of liquor regulation, but not yet the national prohibition law. And Coolidge made friends with people in the bar. He understood that a bar was a business for an immigrant. Maybe it was an Irish immigrant. In the case of Northampton, it was, right? And that when you regulated too much liquor, you might hurt somebody's business. And that also, he had such a pragmatic attitude towards prohibition. Maybe prohibition was bad because, later he thought, because people wouldn't follow it, and that hurt the rule of law generally when people got in the habit of not following a law.
I wanted to come back just for a moment to that idea of over-delivering, because that's useful for someone doing legal work, but it can also be useful in the political sphere. And you start to see, as he moves his way through the Massachusetts legislature, first as a state representative and then later as a state senator, he's starting to master these skills that people don't necessarily know he has mastered. And there's a moment where the state Senate presidency opens up, and he's kind of positioned himself into that job before anyone knew there was a race.
That's right. He travels around. And in Massachusetts, the state Senate presidency matters, because it's not just when there's a tie that you vote, as in Washington, where the vice president, you actually can vote more often than that. And you have a lot of control. And he kind of raced around and made sure he got that job. He had a mentor I want to mention. I just discovered this in researching the book, who was red-haired and silent as well. And that was Murray Crane, a Western Massachusetts businessman. Crane's, the stationery company, right, that we still have. And Murray didn't just print stationery. He also printed, the Cranes did, the U.S. dollar. So if you drive around Western Mass, in the old days you could drive around and people would say, that's the government plant. What they meant was that was the Crane's plant where they printed the dollar. So imagine, and Crane became a senator, and he was extremely silent, did not like speeches, actually hadn't gone to university at all, was a successful businessman, son of a businessman, business dynasty, the Cranes. And he was, I guess Coolidge was his protege, you'd say, and Coolidge was very fond of him, and they were different from the extremely chatty Boston politicians who were snobby like the Lodges. So you want to imagine a rivalry between the Western Mass men, who were more quiet, more business-oriented in some ways, more Main Street-oriented, certainly, and the Boston men who yapped around and went to Harvard.
And he wound up feeling somewhat of an outsider in that culture as he moved up through the ranks. And even when he was governor, there was a call to try and put him in nicer housing. Some of his supporters wanted him to sort of live the part of a high-profile man, and he was always somewhat resistant to that.
Well, yes, and part of it was just thrift, and part of it was political conviction, I want to say. Coolidge really didn't like to owe money because that compromised you politically, right? So he didn't even want a mortgage. He rented half a two-family on Massasoit Street in Northampton. It was a nice half of a two-family, but it was half a two-family. Now, there was a school principal next door. They didn't have a car, even though Grace wanted one. Coolidge didn't really have time to learn about cars. He was in politics his whole life. And of course, when he became governor of Massachusetts, people thought he should have a nice house in Boston, you know, in a nice area. But he didn't like that idea. He didn't really want his children in Boston either. At that time, there was flu. Remember, after World War One, the influenza. Let them stay home in Northampton and wear thrifty clothes, and we'll be sure the heels of their shoes are sold. Their shoes are sold correctly. Stay home. So this offended the Boston snobs, and it really the tension between Lodge and Coolidge is there all along. And I want to say Henry Cabot Lodge, this great famous senator, comes off looking terribly when you study him. He was a narcissist, and he gave Coolidge a hard time, kind of indicating, for example, that he would back Coolidge when Coolidge wanted to run for president, and then backing off that at the crucial moment so that Coolidge had no support.
This was also a time where the country was seeing great unrest between business owners and labor, and that moment where Coolidge was first starting to become a national figure. He was serving as governor of Massachusetts, and there was a strike by the city's police. What happened there?
This is such a dramatic story. So Coolidge was governor. He's a new governor. He was famous for conciliating and getting along with labor, been negotiating this and that, Lawrence, Massachusetts. He, as I said before, important constituents for him were immigrants, including the Irish, who were the police. Then, in addition, the policemen who were striking in 1919 had a good case. They were underpaid. Prices had gone up. Their pay had not gone up commensurate. There was inflation. The government was lying about it. That's similar to now. There were rats in their station houses chewing on the leather in their helmets. There were no bathrooms. You name it, right? And they served ably in the war, overtime. And there are records of the overtime service of these nice policemen that you can see online now because of the wonder of the PDF searchability. It's all there. So they didn't affiliate with communists. Oh, no. They affiliated with the reasonable American Federation of Labor, led by Sam Gompers, whom President Wilson personally liked very much, and so on. And they went out on strike, and people kind of thought the governor, who by an anomaly of that state's rules was in the chain of command with the police, in charge of the police through his commissioner, would, make a deal with them. But there were riots when the police went off duty. This was a very rough time, much rougher than now. The veterans were angry. They were home. They were hurt. They were unemployed. And people were hurt when the police went off duty. There was death, you know, and so on. There was looting of stores. They had to call in the guards. All of a sudden, Boston had to be occupied by our soldiers because the police had gone off duty. And Coolidge backed up the police commissioner. His name was Curtis, not Irish, Anglo, right? So remember that tension. When he fired these policemen for deserting, wow. And Coolidge said a famous line. He telegrammed it to Sam Gompers. He said, "There's no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime."
And this is a very large police force. We're talking about thousands of police at that time. So this was no small act.
It was no, and it was hard to do. Remember how close the election is? In those days, the governor was elected every year. He kind of thought he would lose the election now. But not only that, it was painful because these were nice, good people. Why does it matter politically? It mattered because there were general strikes talked about and even happening in other cities. Some people may have studied Seattle. And the idea was, should we have this kind of public sector labor strike in America? Can we handle it? Can our economy and our society handle it? And Wilson was waffling. And what Coolidge was saying was, no, it's wrong. The public sector, it's a different kind of job. We can't handle it. It's wrong. Someone must draw a line in the sand. So what Coolidge essentially did as a governor, and this happens from time to time, was he upstaged a sitting president. That was Wilson. And the nation said, you know what, that governor over there of Massachusetts might be right. It's wrong to strike. We have to take a stand. But you want to remember what this cost Coolidge. He fell ill. He felt miserable. He had friends who were policemen, and it was sort of like the Budweiser commercial. These were mounted policemen, and their horses whinnied after them with love when they saw them on the street. They didn't want any new policemen, the horses, right? It was kind of a tragedy from the point of view of the police that never went away. They didn't get their jobs back. The new policemen were hired. But it was a turning point for the nation. We had many fewer violent public sector strikes in the 1920s and commensurate additional growth because of that.
Today on The Exchange, a new book reexamining the legacy of President Calvin Coolidge. He's often been downplayed as a major policy player, but his presidency may hold lessons for us today. We're talking with the author of Coolidge, Amity Schlaes, and we hope you'll join us with a call to 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. This moment where he fires the striking Boston police makes him into a national symbol of what his then later running mate Warren Harding terms normalcy. This idea that the country has been through war, it's been through upheaval, a lot of social change, even possibly chaos, and that it's time for some leaders to sort of calm things down. And that's what happens for a while, then, when Harding is elected as president and Coolidge is elected as vice president. And then everything changes a couple of years later in 1923 when Harding is on tour in the western United States and he passes away. What happens? Where's Coolidge, first of all, when this happens?
Well, we said the Coolidges are low-key, and when they vacationed at that time, they tended to vacation at home in Plymouth Notch. Coolidge was working on a he was kind of an arborist. He was working on a tree, going to the dentist, all that, in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, where the telephone service wasn't very firm. They could bring a wire in, but it wasn't very firm. And he learns in the night, in fact, his father tells him that Harding has passed. And he writes in his beautiful autobiography, which I commend to everyone, that he could hear in his father's voice that this call was different. And what's so famous about this scene is that his father swore Coolidge in. His father was a notary. And someone asked later, well, how did you know you had the authority to swear your son in as a notary? And he said, well, nobody told me I didn't. Very American, the real America that would live at a very local level. A notary can do this. A man and a man or a man and a woman can do this. And he was sworn in this little house. And I hope people get to go over to the Calvin Coolidge Memorial Foundation and have a look this summer at how small Coolidge's house is. He didn't live over the store, but he was born behind it in a pretty small place. And then he took the train to Washington and stayed in the hotel for a while in the Willard, and then when Mrs. Harding was ready, moved over to the White House.
There's that famous painting of the scene. You see the father and the son conducting the oath of office, and you see there's candlelight because it's in the middle of the night, and it's come to signify a lot of the character of the Coolidge presidency. And there's a quote that you put in the book, too, when he's asked about how he's, you know, he's just become president. His answer is, of course, is characteristically short. All he says is, "I believe I can swing it." That kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Right. Remember, yes, and remember that Mrs. Harding, I mean, the Hardings were power people. They were best friends with the editors and owners of the Washington Post. Mrs. Harding thought she was somebody, and the Hardings kind of had a low opinion, I think, by the end of Coolidge, the vice president. She was already on the hunt for a new vice president to run with Warren in 1924, someone more charismatic, maybe from, you know, Western, really Western. And so by accidents of history and fate and sorrow, this underestimated man, Coolidge, does become president. And everyone can do arithmetic, and the political people will. He became president in summer of 1923. Well, he's a lame duck, right? Oh, my God, only 13, 14 months and so many days, right, or whatever, until the 24 election. And they kind of expected Calvin, a well of silence, as he was known, to be weak, and not to execute what Harding had promised, that Harding had aborted, wiped out on this mission of government cutting. But Coolidge proved to be the opposite. If you want to know one thing about Coolidge in terms of achievement, he was president from 23 to 29. And when he left office, the federal government was actually smaller than when he came in. And a skeptic would ask, well, is that real, Amity? Is that nominal? They had deflation. It was real. It was nominal. He actually cut the budget even as the economy grew at 3 or 4%. Even as everything expanded, a very good period, much more solid than Great Gatsby would suggest, he cut the budget. So that showed incredible success and determination on the part of Coolidge.
We're going to get into the details of the Coolidge years in the White House after a short break. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with Amity Schles, author of a new book that reexamines the legacy of our 30th president. He's often been downplayed as a major policy player, but his presidency had a big impact on the economic climate of the 1920s. We'll also start to take your calls. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email as well with questions or comments at exchange@nhpr.org. We'll have more after a break. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from the stroke program at Catholic Medical Center, a comprehensive stroke program dedicated to improving recovery rates for stroke patients. Information at CatholicMedicalCenter.org. And Lang McLowry Real Estate, serving the real estate needs of New Englanders from 16 office locations and online at lmsre.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR's Leadership Circle helps to provide a stable base of support for news and information in New Hampshire. I'm Betsy Gardella, president of NHPR and a member of the Leadership Circle. Circle members are, of course, listeners and fans of this service, but with federal funding of public media in a constant state of flux, their individual contributions of $100 a month provide resources we can count on. To find out more about joining the Leadership Circle, visit nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, efforts in higher education to increase flexible and affordable programs. Email us your questions before the show at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today on the program, a book about New England's own Silent Cal. The book is called Coolidge. The author is Amity Schles, author and columnist who writes about politics and the economy. This is her latest book. She's written several, including The Forgotten Man of the New History, A New History of the Great Depression. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Amity Schles, we talked about how Coolidge has made a career of over-delivering, that that people would often underestimate him, and that seems to have been the case even when he became president. The people who had written him off were perhaps surprised that he was able to get a very large cut in the income tax rates passed, that he was able to trim the size of government. Now, these are all things that his predecessor, Warren Harding, had pushed for, but wasn't able to get passed, even though he was well-liked and well-known on Capitol Hill. He had been a former U.S. senator. How did Calvin Coolidge get these things through?
Part of it's temperament. Harding started it. We want to be fair. He got a tax cut. He cut the government. But they wanted to get back to something closer to pre-war level. And the question was, in peacetime, with people beginning to feel good, the 20s began to feel good after 2021, 22, 23, could someone continue in prosperity to cut when there were people clamoring for entitlements? One was the veterans. You want to remember, the veterans came back one-third somehow disabled in a period with no antibiotics. They're in pain. Their leg is rotting. They want a pension. That's a compelling story. Or farmers wanted money. The farms didn't thrive always in the 20s, right, because agricultural commodity prices went down sharply. So how did Coolidge do that? And one area I noticed was discipline. There's a hilarious relationship, or I find it hilarious to observe, between Coolidge and his budget director, General Lord, a true general, from Maine, two New Englanders, and they would get together before cabinet meetings and plan how to say no to the cabinet, because as business people know, it's easy to say yes when you're unprepared in a meeting, but it's hard to say no when you're unprepared, right? You have to be ready to say why you're saying no. So Coolidge worked hard, and we quantified the meetings that Coolidge had, like an accountant, with his budget director, and they would be 40, 50 a year. We have his diary, and he didn't let up. Often presidents who are reelected, Coolidge was elected in 24 on his own the first time, kind of give up. After a while, they get tired. You could see that in Eisenhower giving up on spending in the later 50s. Coolidge did not relent in terms of cutting. He vetoed 50 times some of this is temperament. His temperament was he didn't like to talk, so of course he favored, as a device, the pocket veto, which does not require a message. The chief executive can kill a law, and indeed, we're not able to override a pocket veto. The lawmakers have to make a new law, and he was a sort of Isaac Stern of the pocket veto, which takes some technique. He would kill this legislation and that legislation, even legislation crafted to lure him, such as legislation involving fisheries. People knew he was learning to fish. He would just shut it down because he believed the government should be smaller.
And you started to see an economic rebound at that time on the whole. Now, one of the chief criticisms of Coolidge is that he should have done more to keep the stock market from crashing by 1929. Essentially, why didn't he do something to keep the Great Depression from happening, or at least having it become as bad as it was? What do you make of that criticism?
Well, the Great Depression is a long story. The reason it was great is not the stock market crash. In Coolidge's life, which about tracks the life of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, there were many, many crashes, and none was followed by 11 years of painful unemployment. What the Depression was really in America was not the crash, it was the unemployment. That's why we care, right? Because we remember the stories of people who were jobless year in, year out in the 30s. So there was no reason to expect that we would have 11 years of double-digit employment following that crash. Coolidge did not believe, very few people in America believe, that the federal government was in charge of the stock market. It was regulated by the state of New York at that time. There was no SEC. And his main anxiety was that the stock market did go high. It went, oh my gosh, it tripled towards reaching the heights towards the end of his presidency. And he knew that the crash would feel strong because it was so high. Most of his life it was around 100 or around 70, and here it was going to 381. And he didn't approve of that, but he also thought the federal government would be setting a terrible precedent if it intervened, because when government intervened in markets, well, maybe it could make things worse. So he was trapped, and one of the interesting things we got to do with this book was look at his portfolio, his personal portfolio. And you can see him paring back because he was concerned. He really didn't want to set off a panic, and he didn't think it was the executive's job really to say much. But over at the Fed, with the action of the Treasury, they began to raise interest rates. Some people now would say they didn't raise interest rates too much. They didn't raise them enough. But you can see a federal response at Treasury and Fed to concern about the market. Nowadays, the critics will say, well, they didn't raise interest rates enough. Well, just you want to remember, the interest rates that they had were higher than the ones we had now. So if we say they didn't raise interest rates enough, what are we doing now with our zero interest rates? So this is all, you know, stuff we learned in school. The stock market crash caused the depression. It didn't. Or maybe small government was responsible for the depression. As far as I can tell, it wasn't. In the Forgotten Man, which is the sequel to Coolidge is the prequel, I do address the Great Depression. That's what the book is about and the many, many causes of it.
Coolidge said later on that he felt like he no longer fit in with the times. But hearing you talk about the Great Depression, it doesn't sound as if he's saying that his policies were no longer appropriate for a time of depression or trying to get out of a depression, but simply that they were out of fashion, that there had become an era where there was a feeling that the national government should intervene more to try and boost the economy.
Well, yes, he started out life as a progressive, but he became a state progressive. You know, let's do this law in our state. But he was never a comfortable federal progressive. He didn't really like Washington passing a lot of laws. And he ended up being sort of a man putting his finger in the dike with a progressive wave coming. He stopped the progressive movement. He knew it was coming, and he got tired, but he didn't want to support it. He didn't really think bigger government was the answer. He wouldn't have liked the New Deal. He was sort of, I mean, one of the parallels here is the poet Robert Frost, who also felt out of place when the government got bigger. And I had quite a good look at the poetry of Frost vis-a-vis Coolidge. They didn't know each other, though. Frost taught at Coolidge's school, Amherst. And you can see this tension. I don't approve of the policies that are being promulgated now, but it's not for me to say. That would be Frost's position and Coolidge's. So there he was watching, and of course it was painful to see people lose their jobs. And it's very awkward to do a counterfactual, had Coolidge been president, et cetera. But what is important to note is that Herbert Hoover, the Republican who succeeded Coolidge and campaigned on continuing Coolidge policies, was very different from Coolidge. He was more like a Democrat. And one of the things we'll be talking about tomorrow night, and I hope people do come to Hanover, I'll be working, fortunately, with George Nash, who is the biographer of Hoover. And we're going to draw out the distinctions, different kinds of Republican. Right, different kinds of man. Hoover was an action man. He was more like Theodore Roosevelt, another action man. Coolidge was a non-action man.
And we'll have a link to tomorrow night's event on our website at nhpr.org. At the same time that Coolidge is being a non-action man, there is a lot of action going on across the country. There's a time of massive technological change. I think of the medium in which we're speaking right now. This is when radio first gets underway, but there are so many more inventions and technological advancements that really define the 20th century as we remember it.
That's right. They kind of did television in the 20s. Hoover went on television. Scholars of the markets, there are scholars of the markets, and now the listeners are going to laugh, but there are scholars of the markets who think the stock market was reflecting something real all the way. And what it was reflecting was future innovation, such as television. The market tends to overshoot. And there's a Nobel Prize winner called Prescott who wrote a paper about how the stock market in the late 20s was undervalued because all sorts of cool things like, I don't know, but especially television or different kinds of electronics were in the works in the late 20s. It was a period of ferocious innovation. The patent level was extremely high. The market was excited about all that, probably too excited, probably too early. We didn't get television until the 50s when the stock market finally came all the way back to its 29 level. But there it was. And what I noticed about Coolidge, another surprise to me, was that he was intensely modern. We mentioned before that he came from this village where the railroad chose not to go because the hill was too steep, Plymouth Notch. And if you visit there, you'll see that again. Well, he knew the cost to Plymouth Notch of not getting the railroad, as Ludlow had, as Rutland had. And what a fatal event that was, the decision of the railroad not to go there. And he loved networks. So here he was, a regular data hound and network hound. He loved to ride the trolleys, and he spent a good part of his life either investing in them, trying to help them survive, and so on, because they linked all Western Massachusetts in a way Vermont had not been linked. He loved aviation, and the high point of my book is when Charles Lindbergh does connect Little Plymouth Notch to the world by overflying it and dropping down a note to the city of Plymouth, the great flyer. Coolidge just liked planes not just because they were fast and fun, but because they connected the world. So that's very modern, Facebook-wise, right? And Coolidge, who is this caricature of somebody from Dickens, underneath he's just not that caricature at all. He's as modern as he could be.
Vermont had a high point with Lindbergh dropping that note into Plymouth, but there was also a low point during Coolidge's presidency for that state. There was a massive flood, and there was actually several floods that happened sort of one right after the other across the country. And today, if there were a flood, a president might visit the affected area, promise assistance. And Coolidge, true to his non-action philosophy, did not do that. And it cost him.
Oh, it cost him mostly personally. It cost Vermont, too. What happened was there was a terrible flood, the flood of the Mississippi. But Coolidge did not believe the federal government should intervene. It might supervise and inspire and raise money through the Red Cross. And the Red Cross raised millions, so it's not pennies. That was the way they saw things those days. But it wasn't right for the president to go down because the federal government couldn't be in charge of infrastructure in the states. Things never change. So this is sort of a Chris Christie moment, right? And he sent Hoover, the Commerce Secretary, but he didn't go. And the the flood was so terrible in the South. The politicians from the South said, well, if this happened to Coolidge's neighborhood, he would care more. It was portrayed as coldness. Then he would call an extra session and raise some money and so on. Thaddeus Carraway said that. And then there was a kind of divine retribution because, indeed, Coolidge's neighborhood, which is Vermont, had a terrible flood, so terrible, like the recent one, Irene. And Coolidge was in the middle of vetoing infrastructure spending. So if he went to Vermont, he would be inconsistent as president. He would be favoring one region, his own, over the South, and he chose not to go. And the Vermonters could and couldn't understand. He can't do for his own what he won't do for others, is the quote that was said. But it was very hard. They wrote him letters. They implored him. He didn't go. It was a kind of bleakness. Sometimes you do what you think is the right thing, and other people don't appreciate that. It was one of those moments. And yet, when he did go, after Vermont recovered some, and the legislature borrowed tremendous amounts of money with bonds in Vermont to cover this, the Vermonters greeted him with great love, and he gave a speech that is quoted to this day, the Vermont is a state I love speech. It wasn't that he didn't love Vermont. It was that he didn't believe the federal government should run disasters. So it's so much parallel to today. And I was going to ask Chris Christie what he made of that Coolidge refraining, because Christie, of course, was the one, the Republican. Republicans aren't supposed to be for government spending, who embraced President Obama. And just before the election, because New Jersey was in such terrible trouble, these are the snapshots that crystallize our political issues, our philosophies about government floods. They're terrible, and clearly they have political consequence.
Coolidge famously said in 1928, again, economy of speech, "I choose not to run for another term as president." Is this simply another example of restraint, or was there more to it than that? That he decided it was time to wrap up.
It was certainly mostly restraint. I do follow him in that period. He's looking at Rushmore. He happened to be out there in South Dakota in the Black Hills when Rushmore is going up. The sculptor Gutzon Borglum is wooing him for an appropriation, of course. And he was grossed out, we would say in modern terms, Coolidge was, by the concept of the grandiose presidency, of the man of action ruling history. He preferred office. And thought men should serve office. Very old-fashioned, a bit churchy, quite likable, I think. And he said, well, after a reasonable length of time, it's better to change people. You can see that in his autobiography. So I don't have any evidence he read Lord Acton, who said absolute power corrupts absolutely. But it was the same philosophy that Coolidge had. And the Republican Party then as now was an erratic animal. And it about had a nervous breakdown when Coolidge chose not to run. Coolidge, an austere president, the two points to make are his austerity begat growth. So that's different from what we say today economically. And his austerity, his government austerity, his vetoes were enormously popular. So these are things we sort of can't take in today. Those are two things to take away. And he retired to Northampton, where expected crowds not to come. They did. Very modest family, very quiet, and spoke out for the GOP from time to time, but was mostly quiet.
And you write, to sum it up in a way, the best monument to his presidency was no monument at all.
Right, he didn't want any big. At some point, someone or other said, "Maybe you should have your bust on Rushmore." Well, you had what we want now. You had low unemployment, strong growth, balanced budget, U.S. credit growing, a lot of things we see today. And he shrank from that. He shrank from it. So here's someone, in certain ways stronger than Ronald Reagan. Really cut the government. Reagan didn't cut taxes more to a lower rate than Reagan's. I think he's worth looking at for either party. One of the things that's been wonderful in the subsequent appearance of this book is the strong reviews, but also that I've heard from politicians from both parties, especially budgeteers, the controller here and there by email. I'm a Democrat, but I have to cut the budget in my state. How did he find the spirit to do it? How was he able to say no? What could he tell people? Well, what you can tell people is you might get more jobs if you have a balanced budget. But that is true. So there's a humanity to budget cutting. There's a humanity to the green eye shade.
Well, Amity Schles, it has been wonderful talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Amity Schles is author and columnist who writes about politics and the economy. Her new book is Coolidge. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me and a panel of reporters, editors, and analysts for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
I think the House Democratic Caucus is going to determine whether casino gambling
goes through. And they've created the supercommittee of the House Finance and House Ways and Means Committees to do it as a joint.
14 states now have some sort of a home grow provision in their laws, including, of course, Vermont.
We'll talk through the big Granite State stories of the week. The Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, Friday mornings at 9 on The Exchange from NHPR.